Chapter 7. Schindler's Double Life. On one of the first mornings at Plaschow, Commandant Gurt stepped out of his front door in his riding clothes and fine white shirt, carrying binoculars in one hand and his hunting gun in the other. He looked through the binoculars at the prisoners around the camp. In a relaxed manner, with a cigarette at the corner of his mouth, he took aim and, for no apparent reason, shot one of the prisoners. Gurt had chosen his target out of a group who were pushing and pulling carts of rocks to one of the building sites. The victim's body was thrown across the road when the bullet hit. The other workers stopped pushing, their muscles tensed, waiting for more bullets. But Amon Gurt waved them on. He was finished with them for the moment. This kind of unexpected shooting became a habitual part of the commandant's morning routine, reminding the prisoners that they would never know when it was their turn to die. Such killing was just sport to Gurt and his SS men, but they also believed that it was their duty to murder Jews in order to make room at Plaschow for new prisoners as they arrived from different parts of the German territories. Sometimes the population at Plaschow rose to over 35,000, and the commandant had to find ways to control it. His quick method was to enter one of the camp workshops, order the prisoners to form two lines, and march one of them away. The prisoners in this line would either be taken to a hill behind the camp and shot immediately, or taken to the boxcars at Krakow-Plaschow railway station and sent to the gas chambers in one of the death camps. With his workers living at Plaschow, Oskar Schindler heard about what was going on in Gurt's evil empire. Apart from his extreme solutions to the growing numbers at the camp, Gurt also angered Schindler by breaking his promise that he would do nothing to stop the smooth running of the local factories. One day, Oskar had a telephone call from Julian Madrisch, owner of the Madrisch uniform factory inside the camp, and one of the few other German owners who was trying to keep his 4,000 Jewish workers out of the death camps.
"Have you had any trouble with your workers arriving at DEF on time?" Madrisch asked.
"Yes, almost every day," answered Schindler. "Do you know what's going on?"
"It's Gurt's little games," Madrisch said.
"Yesterday he found a potato hidden in one of the barracks, so every man from that barracks had to be publicly whipped in front of thousands of other prisoners with Commandant Gurt watching. My workers arrived several hours late, still shaking and unable to work properly."
"There is a solution," said Oscar. "I'm thinking of keeping my workers at my factory site, away from Gurt's whips and guns."
"Where would you put them? You don't have the space."
"Not at the moment, but I think I know how to get more land."
Oskar immediately began his efforts to build his own sub-camp beside DEF. He paid a very fair price to an elderly Polish couple for the land attached to the back of his factory, and then went to see Amon Gurt and explained his plan for a sub-camp of Plaschow to be built in his own factory yard. This meant that Oskar would remove a significant number of Jews from Plaschow, perhaps as many as 2,000. And Gurt could make him pay for the new camp, as well as for the continued care of the DEF workers. The commandant thought Oskar was a good fellow who was sick with a form of Jew love, and he did not mind making a profit from his friend's illness. Oskar followed the basic requirements for an SS forced labor subcamp by building 3-meter fences, watchtowers, toilet huts, barracks, medical buildings, a bathhouse, a food store, a laundry and offices. That year, DEF made a fortune for Schindler, but he also spent a small fortune on building his subcamp, and he was only just beginning to pay for the privilege of saving Jewish lives. When news began to spread that Herr Schindler was building his own camp, competition for a place there became fierce. People who got into the new camp would later recall it as a kind of heaven. They were contrasting it with Plaschow, of course, but certainly it was a place where people had hope and a sense of safety. The guards were changed every 2 days, and they looked forward to their time at DEF because the food was better. Herr Schindler was generous with his whiskey, and they were not allowed inside the factory. Their job was boring but easy. Inside Schindler's camp, there were no dogs and no beatings. There was more and better soup and bread than at Plaschow, and even though the prisoners worked long hours, Oskar was still a businessman, with war contracts to fill and a desire for profit. The work was reasonable. At DEF, no one died from overwork, beatings or hunger. Whereas at IG Farben's plant, a typical German factory with workers from Plaschow, 25,000 prisoners out of a workforce of 35,000 would die at their labour. Itzhak Stern, now working in the Plaschow administration office, wanted to get Manashar Levatov, a young intellectual rabbi, into Oskar's subcamp. Stern admired Levatov for his understanding of Jewish law and history, and worried that Goethe would make him a target because he was too intelligent and too well-educated. On a morning when Plaschow held over 30,000 prisoners, the commandant decided to reduce the numbers in the metalworks factory, and Levatov found himself in what seemed to be the safe line. Suddenly, a boy of about 16, who had a good idea of where his line was going, called out, "But, Herr Commandant, I'm a very good metal worker too."
"Yes, child," said Goethe softly. Then he took out his gun and shot the boy in the head. The rest of the men in the line were marched to the train and moved to a death camp. Levatov was sure that the commandant had noticed him and believed he had avoided a bullet from his gun only because the young boy had dared to speak. He would not be safe for long. Within a few days, Goethe returned to the metalworks and began to select prisoners to be taken to the hill to be shot. He stopped beside Rabbi Levatov and asked, "What are you making?"
"Herr Commandant," said Levatov, "I am making machine hinges."
He pointed to the small heap of metal hinges on the floor.
"Make me one now," ordered Goethe.
He looked at his watch and began timing the rabbi. Levatov cut a hinge and put it together as quickly as his nervous fingers would move.
"Another,"
the commandant ordered as soon as the rabbi had finished the first one. After the second metal hinge was completed, Goethe, without raising his eyes from the pile of finished work on the floor, said,
"You've been working here since 6 this morning and can make a metal hinge in less than 1 minute. But you have only made this ridiculous little pile of hinges."
Goethe led the rabbi outside and stood him against the workshop wall. Then he took out his gun, the same one he had used to shoot the 16-year-old boy, held it to Levatov's head, and fired. But nothing happened. Goethe opened his gun, checked the bullets, returned it to Rabbi Levatov's head, and fired again. But still nothing happened. The commandant began cursing wildly before taking a smaller gun from his jacket pocket. Rabbi Levatov knew that Goethe would not be stopped by a technical problem. He began praying again and waited for the gun at his head to fire. But again the gun failed to go off. Now Levatov decided to speak.
"Herr Commandant, I beg to report that I had only a small pile of hinges beside me today because I was sent to carry coal this morning."
Red with anger, Goethe hit the rabbi across the face and stormed away, leaving Levatov against the wall with a bleeding mouth. However, he knew the battle had only come to a temporary stop. Itzhak Stern reported this incident to Oskar Schindler in the building office at Plaschow. When Stern finished, Oskar said,
"Why the long story? There's always room at DEF for someone who can make a metal hinge in less than a minute."
Levatov and his wife moved to the DEF camp in the summer of 1943, and at first the rabbi thought Schindler was making cruel jokes on Friday afternoons when he said,
You shouldn't be here, Rabbi. You should be preparing for holy services.
But when Oscar gave Levatov a bottle of wine for use in the Friday night Jewish ceremonies, the rabbi knew that the head director was not joking. From that day, Levatov was allowed to leave his workbench before the sun went down on Friday afternoons, return to his prisoner's barracks, and do his duty as a rabbi by performing a holy Jewish ceremony. When he was settled in Plaszow, Amon Goeth began to give grand parties, and Oskar Schindler was one of his favourite guests. As much as he enjoyed good food and wine and the company of attractive women, Oskar hated receiving an invitation to a social event from Commandant Goeth. There had, in fact, never been a time when sitting at Goeth's table had not been a disturbing business. But by the autumn of 1943, Oskar found the idea disgusting. As he and his driver approached the gates of the labour camp, Oskar, with an expensive gift in his pocket for Goeth, prepared himself to act the sociable role that was expected of him. He would be a sympathetic listener when Goeth complained about the Jews, or told a joke, or sang a song. He would charm the female guests, usually women who were paid to keep the gentlemen guests happy, and would promise boxes of enamelware to various German officials, all the time smiling and looking for the first opportunity to escape. The idea of getting drunk or having sex at Goeth's house did not appeal to Schindler, and he felt a sense of relief when the commandant finally went upstairs with one of the pretty girls who had been hired to satisfy his wishes. Oskar quickly said good night and left the other guests. In the hall, he saw Helen Hirsch, Goeth's Jewish housekeeper. He and everyone else had noticed this young woman as she served at the dining table, because of the dark bruises along her jaw and even darker, almost purple marks on her thin neck. Oskar had been surprised at dinner by the way Goeth had displayed the girl to the guests, rather than hiding her and her bruises in the kitchen. The girl servant noticed Oskar and stood at attention, waiting for him to order her to do something.
"Please, Helen," said Herr Schindler, "you don't have to be afraid of me. Please, show me your kitchen."
Helen Hirsch was afraid, but she knew she had no choice in these situations. The commandant's guests could order her to do what they wanted. In the kitchen, Oskar asked, like a famous football player or actor,
"Don't you know me? I'm Schindler."
With relief, the girl said, "Herr Director, of course, I've heard. And you've been here before, I remember."
He put his arm around her and touched her cheek with his lips. He whispered,
"Don't worry, Helen. It's not that kind of kiss. I pity you for what you have to bear in this house."
Helen Hirsch began to cry because of Schindler's kind words, and she saw that he was crying too. Then he stood back and looked at her.
"It's Stern told me about you. No one should have to live like you do." "I've accepted my life," said Helen. "One day he'll shoot me. I've seen too many things."
"He enjoys you too much to kill you. It's not decent, but it's life.
If you can keep your health, you can hold on to your life."
"But he'll kill me in the end," said Helen quietly.
"I have a factory. Surely you have heard of it?" asked Schindler.
"Oh, yes," the girl said, like a starving child talking about a palace. "Schindler's DEF. I've heard of it."
"Keep your health. I'll try to get you out of here."
In this crazy world at war, Oskar had become like a character from a story, an almost imaginary figure, the good German. By this time in 1943, he had broken Reich laws to such an extent that he had earned 100 bullets for his own head, or a trip to Auschwitz. But he would not change his ways now. He would continue to spend his money and use his influence to save people like Helen Hirsch.